This podcast is brought to you by Lannan Foundation and is available at podcast.lannan.org. Stuart Dybeck with Michael Silverblatt, recorded in Santa Fe on May 17, 2006. Born and raised on the south side of Chicago, Stuart Dybeck writes of characters so ethnic and working class that they would have appealed to Nelson Algren and his pool room pals. In his novels, short stories, and poetry, Dybeck reflects the magic of ethnicity and the power which oral storytelling has to fashion new myths. After reading from his work, Dybeck joins in conversation with Michael Silverblatt, host and producer of the premier literary talk show on radio, Bookworm.
Well, some of you know that I was going to be staying for this past week here in Santa Fe, and I just want to thank you. If any of you are the people who recognize my voice in restaurants or, stopped me and said, "Aren't you Michael Silverblatt?" And I'd say, "Yes, I am." I mean, I felt so warmly gratified, by this extraordinary attention. And I went to all of your bookstores. You know, what else is a book where I'm going to do? And I loved seeing the town and its pace. It was very, very wonderful to be here. And I want to thank you. If any of you intersected with me, how did you learn to be so kind? You know, I live in Los Angeles. Well, I want to say something that's a little bit tricky, because I want you to just believe me. I absolutely love Stuart Dybeck's work. Having the opportunity to reread all of it, I realized that nothing that gets said about it, and I'll tell you what gets said about it usually, then I'll tell you what I think. What gets said is, because he writes about Chicago, they mention Nelson Algren and Saul Bellow, and I don't think he's even remotely similar to either of them. And then because he writes about childhood, they mention, the Nick Adams stories of Hemingway and some of the stories of Sherwood Anderson. I guess that's the simple people, angle. And I don't think he's anything like them either. Before magic realism, there was a kind of magnificent Eastern European writing that was simultaneously salty, a little bit risque, dark, and magical. And it's absolutely compelling. For me, that began with finding Bruno Schultz. But it's family and mom and dad, but somehow the sensibility refracting them is a sensibility that says, "I don't know anything. They told me stories. Inside the house was not related to outside the house. And I came to believe that walking from school to home was an adventure and that anything could happen on the way back there. And bullies become almost mythological, and smoking your first cigarette becomes a mythic event. And if smoking your first cigarette is a mythic event, touching your first breast is, astonishing. And it's, the perception of life from the point of view that life can still astound, although you're surrounded by everyone's perception outside of how horrible society is, in a story that's in a society, a city, Chicago, that's full of ghettos and blight areas, and how horrible family is when you're, working with butane torches and day and night, and no one's making much money, and no one's getting much sleep. And then there you are in the bedroom with your brother, telling your brother that there's a trap door under your bed, and it goes to Dreamville. And all the stuffed animals you had that you puked on, and they tried to wash, and they didn't come out well, so they threw them away. They're alive down there, talking. But your little brother can't come with you, you know, because he's a little brother. And everything is in that amazing hushed tone, and yet these stories have the pace of action movies. You can't wait to hear what happens next. And I would tell you, you know, honest to God, I just had a conversation with a dear friend, and we were talking about people not reading and why should they read, and my saying to people when people ask me, what should I be reading? And I know that that's, you know, fighting words. And so I say, who says you should be reading? You know? But really, if you read Childhood and Other Neighborhoods, anyone who's given that book is going to fall in love with reading again. It's the real thing. And then when you read The Coast of Chicago, as the amazing magic gets fused with an actual world in that book, and then I Sailed with Magellan. I mean, what an amazing book. I just reread it. And Stuart, told me I'd gotten, you know, I think you have per square inch more body workers than anywhere in America, right here in Santa Fe. So I'd just gotten a very deep tissue massage. and Stuart said, you look blissed out. And I thought it was only partially the massage. It was rereading his work. Now, of course, you can't get these guys, these amazing writers, to know how amazing they are, because to them it's hard work. But for me, a reader, it's like this guy threw magic dust in my eyes and gave me a whole different way of seeing the world, and I love being back there. I find it impossible in a certain sense, because they are so involved with the transition between dream and reality and love and death. They mesmerize me, and they almost swallow themselves at the time I'm done reading, so that when I read them again, it's as if for the first time. It's like a magic spell or a trick that you can even watch carefully and see how it's done and still be amazed and bewildered that someone mastered so much sleight of hand. I think you're going to have an extraordinary time tonight, and I'm very privileged to introduce Stuart Dybeck.
Thank you. It's a real pleasure to be here, and especially to be here in Michael's company. He talked about reading, and one of the great things about writing is that you don't have a viewer, which is passive. You have a reader, which is active. The only other analogy I could think of is the way dancers dance to music, and some readers read the stories that way. Michael's a great dancer. I'm going to read a couple of short poems and then a short story. The poem's called Election Day. Though decked out in the stars and stripes, the polling place was still a funeral home. But then ours was a precinct of funeral homes, the way some neighborhoods are known for their shoe stores or butcher shops. On election day, the usually phantasmal aldermen were out shaking hands, dressed in black cashmere overcoats like proper mourners. The air smelled of cigars and bars and incense from the church whose doors stood open as if at any moment a coffin might come barging into traffic. A cortege of dark caddies lined the toe zones. It might be a deceptive day of two-party weather, one side of the street Indian summer, December on the other, especially when wind muscled the shadows that gathered as if the dead were lurking, lost souls, spirits wandering like drunks, wondering where they'd parked their cars, ghosts, most of them still voting. Tom Boyle read here last week, and we were, terrific writer. We were classmates, and I remember one time he came in with a story called Bloodfall before he'd published the book. It was during the Vietnam era, and Tom never claimed it was any way connected, but it was a story in which blood just begins raining as if in some biblical way. And it only struck me in talking with Michael and asking how Tom's reading went and so on and so forth, that I wonder if this poem called Stain wasn't in some way influenced by that long ago story. Snow was falling last night when I returned to my parish church. Without the snow, I couldn't have traced my old boot prints, nor would the blood have been as easy to follow, trailed as if someone staggering home from the dentist with a handkerchief pressed to his mouth paused every few steps to spit out the taste of metal. Dulled by cold, bells hammered an hour out of tune with the times, as if the daily concussion of chimes had eroded stone, the neighborhood below the steeple stood devastated. Windows blown, walls supported by graffiti, backyards reduced to plots of graves. The waifs, winos, and petty hoods, who once were local heroes, were wanted now for crimes against humanity. Somewhere in hiding, the president prayed. But here a stain was soaking through snow, as if wounds on bodies half buried in frozen earth were leaking through gauze. A stain visible in every exhaled breath, and in the fog fuming from sewers, the exhausts of limousines that idle beneath the blink of bar signs, their brake lights twitching across black ice. Before the embers of bankrupt foundries, the rusted river flowed like an opened vein. This next poem is not by me. It's by one of my favorite poets who died a few years ago without ever winning the Nobel Prize that he was nominated for year after year. He was often described as Israel's finest poet, Yehuda Amichai. And I loved his humor. I loved his humanity. I loved the way he was able to write about the complexity of the world he found himself living in. And I thought at the time I was working on a book of love stories, and one of the things that was in my mind was what vocabulary to use. You know, will one describe things? Will one describe things? And if so, you know, the language of a hygiene class or a bodice ripper or a pornographic film or what exactly. One of my least favorite phrases that I always found incredibly tacky was doing it. I think it's not the doing, but the it. A word that I don't like and is inescapable. And here was one of my favorite poets, at least in translation, with a poem called We Did It. So I tried for a while to write a poem in answer or in response, you know, the way people write a poem on a line by Wallace Stevens or something. And it never worked out. It turned into this story. And so even though I'm a little leery of using epigraphs, it's a lot of baggage for a little story to carry around. I did use an epigraph just in tribute to the Amichai poem that the story was written in response to. But rather than reading the epigraph, the poem is short. I'm just going to read the poem and then go right into the story. So this is the Amichai poem, We Did It. We did it in front of the mirror and in the light. We did it in darkness, in water, and in the high grass. We did it in honor of man and in honor of woman and in honor of God. But they didn't want to know about us. They'd already seen our sort. We did it with imagination and colors, with confusion of reddish hair and brown, and with difficult, gladdening exercises. We did it like wheels and holy creatures, and with chariot feats of prophets. We did it 6 wings and 6 legs, but the heavens were hard above us, like the earth of summer beneath. We didn't. We didn't in the light, we didn't in darkness, we didn't in the fresh cut summer grass or in the mounds of autumn leaves or on the snow or moonlight threw down our shadows. We didn't in your room, on the canopy bed you slept in, the bed you'd slept in as a child, or in the back seat of my father's rusted Rambler with smell of the smoked chubs and kielbasa he delivered on weekends for my Uncle Vincent's meat market. We didn't in your mother's Buick 8 where a rosary twined the rearview mirror like a beaded black snake with silver cruciform fangs. At the dead end of our lover's lane, a side street of abandoned factories where I perfected the pinch that springs open a bra. Behind the lilac bushes in Marquette Park where you first touched me through my jeans and your nipples swollen against transparent cotton seemed the shade of lilacs. In the balcony of the now defunct Clark Theater where I wiped popcorn salt from my palms and slid them up your thighs and you whispered, "I feel like Doris Day is watching us." We didn't. How adept we were at fumbling, how perfectly mistimed our timing, how utterly we confused energy with ecstasy. Remember that night becalmed by heat, and the two of us fused by sweat, trembling as if a wind from outer space that only we could feel was gusting across Oak Street Beach. Entwined in your faded Navajo blanket, we lay soul kissing until you wept with wanting. We'd been kissing all day, all summer. Kisses tasting of different shades of lip gloss and too many cokes. The lake had turned hot pink, rose rapture, pearl amethyst with dusk, then washed in night black with a ruff of silver foam. Behind a momentary horizon, bolts of heat lightning throb, perhaps setting barns on fire somewhere in Indiana. The beach that had been so crowded was deserted as if there was a curfew. Only the bodies of lovers remained visible in lightning flashes, scattered like the fallen on a battlefield, a few of them moaning, waiting for the gulls to pick them clean. On my fingers, your slick scent mixed with the coconut musk of the suntan lotion we'd repeatedly smeared over each other's bodies. When your bikini top fell away, my hands caught your breasts, memorizing their delicate weight, my palms cupped as if bringing water to parched lips. Along the Gold Coast, high rises began to glow, window added to window against the dark. In every lighted bedroom, couples home from work were stripping off their business suits, falling to the bed and doing it. They did it before mirrors and pressed against the glass in streaming shower stalls. They did it against walls and on furniture in ways that required previously unimagined gymnastics, which they invented on the spot. They did it in honor of man and woman, in honor of beast, in honor of God. They did it because they'd been released, because they were home free, alive, and private, because they couldn't wait any longer, couldn't wait for the appointed hour, for the right time or temperature, couldn't wait for the future, for messiahs, for peace on earth, and justice for all. They did it because of the bomb, because of pollution, because of the four horsemen of the apocalypse, because extinction might be just a blink away. They did it because it was Friday night. It was Friday night and somewhere delirious music was playing, flutter-tongued flutes, muted trumpets, meowing like cats in heat, feverish plunking and twanging, tom-toms, congas, gongs, all pounding the same pulse beat. I stripped your bikini bottom down the skinny rails of your legs. You tugged my swimsuit past my tan. Swimsuits at our ankles, we kicked like swimmers to free our legs, almost expecting a tide to wash over us, the way the tide rushes in on Burt Lancaster and Deborah Curran from Here to Eternity, a love scene so famous that although neither of us had seen the movie, our bodies assumed the exact position of movie stars on the sand, and you whispered to me softly, "I'm afraid of getting pregnant," and I whispered back, "Don't worry, I have protection." Then, still kissing you, felt for my discarded cutoffs and the wallet in which, for the last several months, I'd carried a Trojan as if it was a talisman, Still kissing, I tore its flattened, dried-out wrapper, and it sprang through my fingers like a spring from a clock and dropped to the sand between our legs. My hands were shaking. In a panic, I groped for it, found it, tried to dust it off, tried as Burt Lancaster never had to slip it on without breaking the mood, felt the grains of sand inside it, a throb of lightning, and the great lake behind us became, for all practical purposes, the Pacific, and your skin tasted of salt. And to the insistent question that my hips were asking, your body answered yes, your thighs opened like wings from my waist as we surfaced, panting from a kiss that left you pleading, oh Christ, yes, a yes. Gasped sharply as a cry of pain, so that for a moment I thought we were already doing it, and that somehow I'd missed the instant when I entered you in the bloodless way in which a young man discards his own virginity, entered you as if passing through a gateway into the rest of my life, into a life as I wanted it to be lived. Yes, but oh, then I realized we were still floundering, unconnected in the slick between us. There was sand in the Trojan as we slammed together, still feeling for that perfect fit, still in the here, groping for an eternity. That was only a fine adjustment away, just a millimeter to the left or a fraction of an inch further south. Though with all the adjusting, the sandy Trojan was slipping off and then it was gone. But yes, you kept repeating, although your head was shaking, no, not quite, almost, and our hearts were going like mad. And you said, yes, yes, wait, stop. What? I asked, still futilely thrusting as if I hadn't quite heard you. Oh, God, you gasped, pushing yourself up. What's coming? Jim, what's the matter? I asked, confused. And then the beam of a spotlight swept over us, and I glanced into its blinding eye. All around us, lights were coming, speeding across the sand. Blinking blindness away, I rolled from your body to my knees, feeling utterly defenseless in a way that only nakedness can leave one feeling. Headlights bounded toward us, spotlights crisscrossing, blue dome lights revolving as squad cars converged. I could see other lovers caught in the beams fleeing bare-ass through the litter of garbage that daytime hordes have left behind and night had deceptively concealed. You were crying, clutching the Navajo blanket to your breasts with one hand, clawing for your bikini with the other, and I was trying to calm your terror with reassuring phrases such as, holy shit, I don't fucking believe this. Swerving and fishtailing in the sand, police calls pouring from their radios. The squad cars were on us and then were by us while we struggled to pull on our clothes. They braked at water's edge and cops slammed out, brandishing huge flashlights, their beams deflecting over the dark water. Beyond the darting of those beams, the far-off throbs of lightning seemed faint by comparison. Over there, goddammit, one of them hollered, and two cops slashed out into the shallow water without even pausing to kick off their shoes, huffing aloud for breath, their cartridge belts creaking against their bellies. Grab the son of a bitch, it ain't gonna bite, one of them yelled. And they came slashing back to the shore with a body slung between them. It was a woman, young, naked, her limp body bluish beneath the play of flashlight beams. They set her on the sand just past the ring of drying, washed-up alewives. Her face was almost totally concealed by her hair. Her hair was brown and tangled in a way that even wind or sleep can't tangle hair, tangled as if it had absorbed the ripples of water, thick strands, slimy looking like dead seaweed. She's been in there a while, that's for sure. A cop with a beer belly said to a younger crew-cut cop who'd knelt beside the body and removed his hat as if he might be considering the kiss of life. The crew-cut officer brushed the hair away from her face, and the flashlight beam settled there. Her eyes were closed. A bruise or a birthmark stained the side of one eye. Her features appeared swollen, her lower lip protruding as if she was pouting. An ambulance siren echoed across the sand, its revolving red light rapidly approaching. Might as well take their sweet-ass time, the beer-bellied cop said. We had joined the circle of police surrounding the drowned woman almost without realizing we had. You were back in your bikini, robed in the Navajo blanket, and I had slipped on my cutoffs, my underwear dangling out of a back pocket. Their flashlight beams explored her body, causing its whiteness to gleam. Her breasts were floppy, her nipples looked shriveled, her belly appeared inflated by gallons of water. For a moment, a beam focused on her mound of pubic hair, which was overlapped by the swell of her belly, and then moved almost shyly away down her legs, and the cops all glanced at us, at you especially, above their lights, and you hugged your blanket closer as if they might confiscate it as evidence or to use as a shroud. When the ambulance pulled up, one of the black attendants immediately put a stethoscope to the drowned woman's swollen belly and announced, "Drowned the baby, too." Without saying anything, we turned from the group as unconsciously as we joined them and walked off across the sand, stopping only long enough at the spot where we'd lain together like lovers in order to stuff the rest of our gear into a beach bag, to gather our shoes, and for me to find my wallet and kick sand over the forlorn, deflated Trojan that you pretended not to notice. I was grateful for that. Behind us, the police were snapping photos, flash bulbs throbbing like lightning flashes, and the lightning itself still distant, but moving in closer, rumbling audibly now, driving a lake wind before it so that gusts of sand tingled against the metal sides of the ambulance. Squinting, we walked toward the lighted windows of the Gold Coast, while the shadows of gapers attracted by whirling emergency lights hurried past us toward the shore. "What happened? What's going on?" they asked, without waiting for an answer. And we didn't offer one, just continued walking silently in the dark. Not over. Just water. It was only later that we talked about it. And once we began talking about the drowned woman, it seemed we couldn't stop. She was pregnant, you said. I mean, I don't want to sound morbid, but I can't help thinking about the whole time we almost... You know, there was this poor dead woman and her unborn child washing in and out behind us. It's not like we could have done anything for her, even if we had known she was there, I said. But what if we'd found her? What if after we had, you know, you said, your eyes glancing away from mine and your voice tailing into a whisper. What if after we did it, we went for a night swim and found her in the water? But Jin, we didn't, I tried to reason. That was no more a matter of reason than anything else between us had ever been. It began to seem as if each time we went somewhere to make out on the back porch of your half-deaf, whiskery Italian grandmother who sat in front of the apartment cackling at I Love Lucy reruns, or in your girlfriend Tina's basement rec room when her parents were away on bowling league night, or way off in the burbs at the Giant Twin Drive-In during the weekend they called Elvis Fest, the drowned woman was with us. We'd kiss, your mouth would open, and when your tongue flicked repeatedly after mine, I'd unbutton the first button of your blouse, revealing a beauty spot at the base of your throat, which matched the smaller spot I loved above a corner of your lips. And then the second button, which opened on a delicate gold cross, which I had always tried to regard as merely a fashion statement, dangling above the cleft of your breasts. The third button exposed the lacy swell of your bra, and I'd slide my hand over the patterned mesh, feeling for the firmness of your nipple rising to my fingertip, but you'd pull slightly away, and behind your rapid breath, your kiss would grow distant, and I'd kiss harder, trying to lure you back from wherever you'd gone, and finally holding you as if only consoling a friend, I'd ask, "What are you thinking?" Although, of course, I knew. I don't want to think about her, but I can't help it. I mean, it seems like some kind of weird omen or something, you know? "No, I don't know," I said. "It was just a coincidence. Maybe if she'd been further away down the beach. But she was so close to us. A good wave could have washed her right up beside us." "Great. Then we could have had a menage a trois." "Gross. I don't believe you just said that. Just because you said it in French doesn't make it less disgusting." "You're driving me to it. Come on, Jin. I'm sorry," I said. "I was just making a dumb joke to get a little different perspective on things. What's so goddamn funny about a woman who drowned herself and her baby?" "We don't even know for sure she did." "Yeah, right, it was just an accident. She just happened to be going for a walk, pregnant, naked, and fell in, and she could have been on a sailboat or something. Accidents happen, so do murders. Oh, like murder makes it less horrible. Don't think that hasn't occurred to me. Maybe the bastard who knocked her up killed her, huh?" "How should I know? You're the one who says you don't want to talk about it and then gets obsessed with all kinds of theories and scenarios. Why are we arguing about a woman we don't even know, who doesn't have the slightest thing to do with us?" "I do know her," you said. "I dream about her." "Dream about her?" I repeated, surprised. "Dreams you remember? Sometimes they wake me up. And one, I'm at my Nona's cottage in Michigan, swimming for a raft that keeps drifting farther away until I'm too tired to turn back. Then I notice there's a naked person sunning on the raft and start yelling, "Help!" She looks up and offers me a hand, but I'm too afraid to take it, even though I'm drowning, because it's her. God, Jin, that's creepy. I dreamed you and I are at the beach and you bring us a couple of hot dogs, but forget the mustard, so you have to go all the way back to the stand for it. Hot dogs, no mustard, a little Freudian, isn't it? Honest to God, I dreamed it. You go back for mustard, and I'm wondering why you're gone so long. And then a woman screams, a kid is drowned, and everyone stampedes for the water, and I'm swept in by the mob and forced under, and I think, this is it, I'm going to drown. But I'm able to hold my breath longer than could ever be possible. It feels like a flying dream, flying underwater. And then I see this baby down there, flying too, and realize it's the kid everybody thinks is drowned, but he's no more drowned than I am. He looks like Cupid or one of those baby angels that cluster around the face of God. Pretty weird. What do you think those symbols mean? Hot dogs, water, drowning. It means the baby who drowned inside her that night was a love child, a boy, and his soul was released there to wander through the water. You don't really believe that. We argued about the interpretation of dreams, about whether dreams are symbolic or psychic, prophetic, or just plain nonsense until you said, look, Dr. Freud, you can believe what you want about your dreams, but keep your nose out of mine, okay? We argued about the drowned woman, about whether her death was a suicide or a murder, about whether her appearance that night was an omen or a coincidence, which you argued is what an omen is anyway, a coincidence that means something. By the end of summer, even if we were no longer arguing about the woman, we'd acquire the habit of arguing about everything else. What was better, dogs or cats, rock or jazz, Cubs or Sox, tacos or egg rolls, right or left, night or day? We could argue about anything. It no longer required arguing or necking to summon the drowned woman. Everywhere we went, she surfaced by her own volition, at Rocky's Italian Beef, at Lindo Mexico, at the House of Dong, our favorite Chinese restaurant, a place we still frequented because when we first started seeing each other, they'd let us sit and talk until late over tiny cups of jasmine tea and broken fortune cookies. We'd always kid about going there. Are you in the mood for Dong tonight? I'd whisper conspiratorially. It was a dopey joke, meant for you to roll your eyes at its repeated dopiness. Back then in winter, if one of us ordered the garlic shrimp, we'd both be sure to eat them so that later our mouths tasted the same when we kissed. Even when she wasn't mentioned, she was there with her drowned body so dumpy next to yours, and her sad breasts with their wrinkled nipples and sour milk so saggy beside yours, which were still budding. With her swollen belly and her pubic bush, colorless in the glare of electric light, with her tangled, slimy hair and her pouting, placid face, so lifeless beside yours, and her skin a pallid white, lightning flash white, flash bulb white, a whiteness that couldn't be duplicated in daylight. How I'd come to hate that pallor, so cold beside the flush of your skin. There wasn't a particular night when we finally broke up, just as there wasn't a particular night when we began going together, but it was a night in fall when I guessed it was over. We were parked in the Rambler at the dead end of the street of factories that had been our lover's lane, listening to a drizzle of rain and dry leaves sprinkle the hood. As always, rain revitalized the smells of smoked fish and kielbasa in the upholstery. The radio was on too low to hear. The windshield wipers swished at intervals as if we were driving, and the windows were steamed as if we'd been making out. But we'd been arguing, as usual, this time about a woman poet who'd committed suicide, whose work you were reading. We were sitting, no longer talking or touching, and I remember thinking, I didn't want to argue with you anymore. I didn't want to sit like this in hurt silence. I wanted to talk excitedly all night as we once had. I wanted to find some way that wasn't corny sounding to tell you how much fun I'd had in your company, how much knowing you had meant to me, and how I'd suddenly realized I'd been so intent on becoming lovers, I'd overlooked how close we'd been as friends. I wanted you to know that. I wanted you to like me again. Sad, I started to say, meaning I was sorry we had reached the point of silence. But before I could continue, you challenged the statement. What makes you so sure it's sad? What do you mean, what makes me so sure? I asked, confused by your question. You looked at me as if what was sad was that I'd never understand. For all either one of us knows, you said, death could have been her triumph. Maybe when it really ended was that night I felt we just reached the beginning. That one time on the beach in summer when our bodies rammed together so desperately that for a moment I thought we did it. Maybe in our hearts we did, although for me then doing it in one's heart didn't quite count. If it did, I supposed we'd all be Casanovas. We rode home together on the L that night, and I felt sick and defeated in a way I was embarrassed to mention. Our mute reflections emerged like negative exposures on the dark, greasy window of the train. Lightning branched over the city, and when the train entered the subway tunnel, the lights inside flickered as if the power was disrupted, though the train continued rocketing beneath the loop. When the train emerged again, we were on the south side of Chicago, and it was pouring, a deluge as if the sky had opened to drown the innocent and guilty alike. We hurried from the L station to your house, holding the Navajo blanket over our heads until, soaked, it collapsed. In the dripping doorway of your apartment building, we said goodnight. You were shivering. Your bikini top showed through the thin blouse plastered to your skin. I swept the wet hair away from your face and kissed you lightly on the lips. Then you turned and went inside. I stepped into the rain, and you came back out calling after me. What? I asked, feeling a surge of gladness to be summoned back into a doorway with you. Want an umbrella? I didn't. The downpour was letting up. It felt better to walk back to the station, feeling the rain rinse the sand out of my hair, off my legs, until the only places where I could still feel its grit were in the crotch of my cutoffs and each squish of my shoes. A block down the street, I passed a pair of jockey shorts lying in a puddle and realized they were mine, dropped from my back pocket as we ran to your house. I left them behind, wondering if you'd see them and recognize them the next day. By the time I climbed the stairs back to the L platform, the rain had stopped. Your scent still hadn't washed from my fingers. The station, the entire city, it seemed, dripped and steamed. The summer sound of crickets and nighthawks echoed from the drenched neighborhood. Alone, I could admit how sick I felt. For you, it was a night that would haunt your dreams. For me, it was another night when I waited, swollen and aching, for what I had secretly nicknamed the Blue Ball Express. Literally lovesick, groaning inwardly with each lurch of the train and worried I was damaged for good, I peered out at the passing yellow-lit stations where lonely men stood posted before giant advertisements, pictures of glamorous models defaced by graffiti, the same old scrawled insults and pleas, fuck you, eat me. At this late hour, the world seemed given over to men without women, men waiting in abject patience for something indeterminate, the way I waited for our next times. I avoided their eyes so that they wouldn't see the pity in mine, pity for them, because I'd just been with you. Your scent was still on my hands, and there seemed to be so much future ahead. For me, it was another night like that. By the time I reached my stop, I knew I'd be feeling better, recovered enough to walk down the dark street home, making up poems of longing I never wrote down. I was the D.H. Lawrence of not doing it, the voice of all the would-be lovers who ached and squirmed. From our contortions and doorways on stairwells and the bucket seats of cars, we could have composed the Kama Sutra of interrupted bliss. Must have been that night when I recalled all the other times of walking home after seeing you, so that it seemed as if I was falling into step behind the parade of my former selves, myself walking home on the night we first kissed, myself on the night when I unbuttoned your blouse and kissed your breasts, myself on the night when I lifted your skirt above your thighs, dropped to my knees, each succeeding self another step closer to that irrevocable moment for which our life seemed poised. But we didn't. Not in the moonlight or by the phosphorescent lanterns of lightning bugs in your backyard, not beneath the constellations we couldn't see, let alone decipher, or in the dark glow that replaced the real darkness of night, a darkness already stolen from us, not with the skyline rising behind us while a city gradually decayed, not in the heat of summer while a cold war raged, despite the freedom of youth and license of first love, because of fate, karma, luck, what does it matter? We made not doing it a wonder, and yet we didn't. We didn't. We never did.
That concludes the reading for this event. Next up is the conversation.
I have a suggestion. You know, all the time I have friends who don't read. Of course, this makes me cry. It's a complicated thing. But I wanted to say that I know from personal experience that giving people who don't read books by Stuart Dybeck often rectifies the situation. And you know, they're the Garcia Street books people are outside with the books, and he'll be signing them in the lobby. And Get them not for yourself, but for those people who stopped doing this ancient and crucial thing, because they'll thank you for it, and they'll say, oh, I forgot that it could be that great, okay? You know? The books, you know, began with a book called Brass Knuckles, which I don't even have a copy of. They keep saying they're going to be reissuing it, and I suppose they will. It was a book of poetry. But then came The Coast of Chicago. First came Childhood and Other Neighborhoods, and then came The Coast of Chicago, and then came I Sailed with Magellan, and most recently a book of poetry called Streets in Their Own Ink. And, you know, there aren't many starter books. I mean, I often find The Breakfast at Tiffany's is another one, you know, that you can give to anyone, and they'll come to you and say, oh, thank you so much. And this is one. I kind of promise, because more serious to me than being smart is being able to be in love with something and spreading the love to others so that they don't think you're fucking with their heads or anything, you know what I mean? It's not, you know, because it's good for them. It's not because they'll be better or wiser. It's because it will make them more human, and we need that. So, yeah. Well, as usual, I've read a lot of interviews with you, and I don't plan to ask any of those questions.
That's good there.
but I do think that some things that no one talks to you about are important. That is to say that in many of these stories, while you revile Catholicism, they are stories of belief, or they come out of communities that took belief seriously. And the stories partake, even when rejecting, in the seriousness of what belief means to a community. And I wanted to ask you about that, because, you know, a lot of writers are simply angry at the way they were trained. And this isn't ambivalence. This is love born out of frustration, mm-hmm. or something like that.
Well, I think everybody's relationship with religion is kind of complicated. It's one of the ways you have a relationship with Catholicism is rejecting it and then spending the rest of your life making fun of it. I mean, that's an actual type that I suppose in some ways characters in my stories have fallen into. But the whole notion of religion itself, number one, is it all religion supplies a language of awe, a language by which we describe other worlds and other states of emotion, of being, of dreaming. And so one loots that vocabulary. You know, words like, and again, Catholicism hardly has cornered the market on that, but because of its... because it is a religion that's really big on ritual, it is rich in that, in fact. But the other one is that I've always made a distinction, I think, between two distinctions. One is between what you're taught ethically and what you find out really is the way the world works. And I think everybody who lives in this democracy, which is a democracy that's also a capitalist system, it has that same, you have that same conflict with idealism. But the other one is that religion is, it fascinates me as culture. And I think the sympathy in the stories is almost always for the culture, even if, and the culture's need, requirement, love for the religion, even if on another level you kind of feel that it's possibly another element that's actually taking advantage of them. So that complex web is there to mess around with in various narratives.
When you say awe, I do notice that the language is plain, but it's propelled by cadence, which sometimes seems to be the cadence of prayer, mm-hmm. or might be the cadence of jazz, or kind of an improvisation. But it seems to me that the extension of awe is moving through all kinds of situations with a cadence that keeps swelling and growing and building, so that it's sort of like poetry, mm-hmm. these stories.
Yeah. Rhythm is a hugely ecstatic element. And, one other thing I could have said that applies to this, but it was also an answer to your other question, is that in a lot of my stories, in some ways, they're about perception. And what happens in the story is that a perceptual shift occurs that changes a character's life. It might not even be a dramatic incident. And as Lewis Carroll has taught us, for perceptual shifts to occur, you need a rabbit hole. And, you know, for me, a rabbit hole can be a corner bar with a great jukebox, or it can be the doors of a church. And what happens is that once you go into an alternative world where the rules are different, even after you've come out of that world, it now has changed the ordinary world that you've... I remember as a kid being kind of fascinated by the sense that you could be walking down the street. The neighborhood I grew up in had a lot of alcoholism was a huge scourge in that neighborhood, and there were alcoholics at every corner. There was a bar at every corner. So you'd be walking down the street, and there would be just the regular neighborhood scene of alcoholics and delivery trucks and gangbangers and what have you. Just a normal everyday day. And then these doors would open, and you would pass this bloody Christ, and within the church there'd be this completely, you know, languages would be different. There might be a sodality of Polish ladies on one side of the church speaking in the rhythms of Eastern Europe, and on the other side of the church a sodality of Spanish, Chicanos, speaking Spanish, and bad organ playing coming from the organ loft, and the smell of the Middle Ages, which I've always thought of as incense being, rather than somebody hiding their dope. So all those sensual details signal the change. And so I think a lot of times when you're trying to recreate it on the page, one of the things that you're trying to do is offer the reader a palette of sensual detail, which are all cues. And one of the most powerful ways to offer sensual detail is through prose rhythm.
It's also amazing to me because, you know, the stories have a lot of laughter. And then a nun shows up and says, "Don't laugh." You know, that naked pregnant woman who comes out of the waves is like a nun, mm-hmm. saying, "You thought this was funny? Okay, here we go. We're going to take you to task." Mm-hmm. And it is funny, but not in God's world, you know? And that's part of the amazing thing. I think that one of the hallmarks of the Stuart Dybeck story is that you laugh and you don't laugh at the same time. Just last night in one of the stories in Child in Another Neighborhoods, I think, a bad speller writes a love letter and tells the woman that he wants to sit with his arms around her waist, waste. And the story works both ways, because we like this guy, and we like this girl who doesn't like the love letter. She writes an eyebrow pencil on it that he's a jerk.
Stupido.
And that suspension of laughter, making you laugh and making you stop laughing, is kind of an amazing acrobatic feat.
Yeah. Well, I've always been fond of that. I mean, sometimes I think of these things just as moves. And it's a move that I've always loved. Sometimes you don't know where you've learned something. What you remember is where you've become aware of it. But I mean, certainly it's in books like Catch 22, one of the books that is one of my favorite books in American fiction. But where I became very aware of it was actually in a movie called The Ruling Class. I don't know if you're familiar with it. It's a Peter O'Toole film, and it begins like a wacky British comedy. A guy thinks he's Jesus Christ, and he's kind of whacked out about it. And in order for him to inherit the family fortune, he has to become sane. And there's all these plots from keeping him from becoming sane, and he finally manages to become sane. He even gets a seat in the House of Lords. And, you know, the whole three quarters of the film, you're chuckling along and suddenly you realize that he can't tolerate sanity. And his next fantasy is not Jesus Christ, but Jack the Ripper. And the film just takes a brutally violent turn after you've thought for a good long time it was a whacked out comedy. And You know, you have to be very careful that the audience doesn't get angry at that, at the trick. But if you can pull it off, and it worked very well for me in that film, it's a wonderful move.
I want to share with the audience, see, many people who've seen that film don't know, and it's an example of what you're talking about, that it was based on a book. The book was called Three Christs of Ypsilanti. Mm-hmm. And they brought to Ypsilanti, is that in Michigan?
Yep.
Oh, wow. They brought to Ypsilanti three people from around the country, each of whom believed he was Christ. And they thought, well, maybe it will be helpful if we put them in the room together and let them talk to one another. Because how could there be three Christs? Even Christ would know that. And between the chapters of analysis, right, they reprint transcripts of these conversations. And not only are they deeply serious and hilarious, two of them, you know, had come from the Midwest, Detroit, and they compared their Christhood in terms of cars and gasoline. You are no Christ. I have 60 horsepower. I have four trucks, three cars. You are not Christ. And you know, you just sit there going, yeah. And this is the Stuart Dybeck point, that the holy is infused by the everyday, and that where you come from is your impulse about spirituality and ecstasy.
Yeah, I agree.
Oh. But I wanted to mention that. You see, one critic who wrote about the book, a guy named Stephen Marcus, noticed that the three Christs sounding like characters in Samuel Beckett plays. And that's what's going on in these books, too, mm-hmm. that the people in their everyday language, what William Carlos Williams called the language of Polish grandmothers, are speaking about spirit, no matter how far they seem to want to get away from the church.
Mm-hmm. And then, you know, there's that whole notion as well as of unassimilated populace, so that a lot of the behaviors that seem mysterious are mysterious because you're living in an American population and you don't have, as a first or second or third generation, you don't have access to the folkways that are at work, committing. I mean, we always think of Creole religions as something that takes place in the Caribbean or New Orleans or so on and so forth. But in fact, religions always creolize with whatever the population is. So you know, if you get a bunch of people who move from Poland or Czech Republic or what have you to the United States, there's this weird creolization that's gone on or the Hispanic population from Mexico that was dominant in my neighborhood. And it just kind of leaves you unrooted in this flow of images and beliefs and half digested religious notions. So I'm fascinated by that soup and to kind of create it and then let the characters swim in it. I never know exactly what they're going to do then in those stories. It's kind of interesting to see where they'll end up.
Yeah, that juxtaposition of imagery, which is, you know, part of poetry. Who expects these two lovers at the beach in this story to have a corpse wash up? Mm-hmm. It's like another poem. There's a funny poem going on, and another poem kind of slides into it. Mm-hmm. And you know, the stories seem to work that way, almost as if you can't know where your stories are going to go until the interruption comes.
Well, I mean, a lot of writers talk about the notion that writing is an exploration. And I mean, that's very true for me. I'm kind of uncomfortable when I know where a story's going, which isn't to say I'm comfortable when I don't. But at least I don't have a model holding up and to hold up and shame me. There's just a lot of kind of confusion at the end of it. And you know, with that particular story, I had no idea there was going to be a drowned woman. I was vaguely aware that I was somewhat fascinated by the notion that we think everything has to be about something that happened, where frequently it's the negative that's the powerful influence. It's what doesn't happen that actually forms the life rather than what happens. So I was very vaguely aware of playing around with that notion, and I have no idea where the drowned girl came from. But
was she always in the same
story?
No,
she wasn't there at all. When I was trying to write a poem addressed to the Amakai poem, there was no drowned woman whatsoever. I think what it was for me was at first was just a kind of a comic moment. What if?
Yeah.
And then once she was in there, it became necessary to see what would happen.
Because also in I Sailed with Magellan, there's a story that I really love. It's called The Blue Boy. Is that the Blue Boy?
Blue Boy.
Yeah, and it's kind of like this. A child lives past the age at which he's expected to live. His lips are blue, his skin is partially blue. And then, before he's had the chance to take his first communion, he dies. He's been in Catholic school, his brother is there. And the story is amazing because, you know, well, of course, a nun tells them to write stories. This is, I think, in the background of all the Stuart Dybeck stories. There's a nun who needs to be put in her place by the story being written. And the good girl, who turns out to be not so good, writes, you know, the Christmas carol about the blue boy. And the brother says, that wasn't my brother. Had, you know, why the fuck are you writing about him this way? He was a real person. He wasn't the Christmas Carol. He's not Tiny Tim. And then the narrator has an uncle who deserves a story too. And everyone's trying to write this story in which emotion and sincerity, in which it's possible to break your heart again. But there's some kind of thing preventing it every single time. And these stories blend together at different levels of aspiration. You know, some of them just there to make you laugh, and then you feel bad because you're not supposed to laugh at this stuff. And mm-hmm. why can't we? Why can't we laugh at it? And why can't we speak in ways that break each other's heart anymore? Why can't the Christmas Carol be written? Why isn't there a Charles Dickens, and a writer who everyone loves because his emotions are so accurate to the state of our times? And the story takes on all of that kind of jostling and feeling uncomfortably shifting at every turn. And it's amazing. I mean, it's sort of like you've kind of taken on that big question, why can't writing do what it's supposed to do, what it always used to be able to do?
Mm-hmm. Well, that one started out as a memoir of, and it really was, I mean, a lot of that story actually, not that this, I finally decided to call it a piece of fiction. But a lot of the stories in there were based on things that I just remembered from growing up. And one of them was that there was a young woman who in the Blue Boy story is called Camille Estrada. One of the things that's always fascinated me about neighborhoods and opportunities, its social class in the United States, education, is how many wonderfully gifted kids you meet along the way who don't make it. And I've got a story called The Death of the Right Fielder, and it's a black comedy in which the bunch of kids are playing a pickup baseball game, and suddenly they realize that every time the ball goes out to right field, it never comes back. They walk out there, and the right fielder's dead. They decide to bury him in the baseball field. But there's this line in the story about how many Roberto Clementes have we never heard about, you know? And the Camille Estrada in the Blue Boy story came back to me in that way. She was the greatest writer I've ever met. I mean, I remember this Hispanic girl when I was in grade school, and she had already written about 4 or 5 novels that we had in our school library, bound up in loose leaf. And she started a school newspaper, and she won the writing contest every year. And I just suddenly began wondering, whatever happened to her? I mean, I have no idea. I tried to track her down, and I couldn't. And I think after I wasn't able to track her down and find out what happened to her, I decided it was a piece of fiction. But that somehow that got mixed in with this Ralphie with the story of the Blue Boy himself and his early death. So in one way, that story, if you cobble enough stories on the same subject together into one form, this one being a novella, it can't help but at least on one level be about that. So then my father's story gets into it, and what happens to my father when he's a little boy. And so you know, among other things, there's a lot of stories about snuffed out possibilities in childhood. And that becomes one layer. And to me, Dickens and Freud are two of the great thinkers on childhood, two of the great friends that childhood has had. And so I couldn't help but, you know, it goes association to association, and pretty soon Dickens is in there, and the next thing you know, you're wondering yourself about how sentimentality becomes an issue.
But I think the writer also becomes sort of like one of those cartoon characters who has an angel pop up on one shoulder and a devil on the other. And, you know, you're writing about this Camille Estrada, but she's getting to be too good. And so it's revealed that she's been wearing falsies to school, covered by a sweater. And, of course, there's the nun. The nun says, take off your sweater. And she... it becomes another angel-devil battle, which recurs later on when the narrator goes to the library and discovers that one of the stories that Camille Estrada has written is awfully close to a Ray Bradbury story. In other words, You don't sit still for a minute. The moral valence of things keeps shifting, and it's what makes these stories such a like a celebration of life, because no thing is only one thing at a time.
Yeah. Well, I love that. Then there's another thing that just as I listened to you describe this story, which is sounding pretty good.
Yeah, I think it took a hell of a time to write, you know. I just think it's an amazing story you can't tell stories easily. Yeah.
But one of the things as I'm listening to your description that I remember about it is the sheer that sometimes as one is going along, just the sheer vitality of the crazy stuff that kids continue to do, you know, how that in itself becomes its own engine, the recollection of those different kinds of vitalities. I'm just thinking of this scene in the story where the nun decides that the bad boys in class need to have partners in Christ, so she pairs them up with the good girls, which is incredibly humiliating, of course, for the boys. And just horrible for the girls, so that they have to sit next to each other, and each couple is this partner in Christ, and there's this, to avenge himself and win back his honor, the baddest of the bad boys, Norky, takes a balloon, one of those sausage balloons, and blows it up, and slides it in through his pants so that it comes out of his fly. And that's how Partners in Christ ends with the nun who's been pointing with her pointer, seeing this dashing down the aisle and trying to pop his balloon with this pointer, and
well, it's not only that, because the very best girl and the maybe not so very bad narrator get to go out together, what else? To clap erasers on the wall. And sort of like the couple on the beach, they find themselves writing that copulating verb together.
Well, they're both wannabe writers.
Yeah.
And the first word that they share... since they're partners in Christ, the bad boy is out with the good girl, and the good girl always gets to beat the erasers. So she gives him the erasers, and the first thing he starts beating on the wall is F, U. And I think she says, I really like your vocabulary. Maybe I should have read that one.
Well, no one's really discovered that story. As I was reading it, I just said, wow, watch this go up, pardon me, but watch this go up and down. You know, I mean, it's just a magnificent thing. And then, you know, like, people always say that they don't get it because, you know, like, if you live and also read... Mm-hmm. You expect certain things of stories. You know in your life that reversals, contradictions, non sequiturs appear 1,000 times a day, but you want a story to go from A to B. And what's so great about these stories is they find ways to integrate into themselves all these contradictions and impossibilities, changes of mood and decisions and alterations, you know, what Grace Paley calls in her title, enormous changes at the last minute. That every character deserves the generosity of the vastness of real life.
Mm-hmm. I agree, except I'm agreeing about my own story. So it sounds horribly vain, but...
Well, part of what I want to do is to remind writers how good they are.
They'll appreciate it.
I've been speaking to Stuart Dybeck, who has joined us. He is going to be moving from the college where he's taught for 17 years in Kalamazoo, Michigan, to Northwestern University. And during lunch, I thought, well, you know, the students, they always report whenever they do these interviews with him that he's the most amazing teacher of writing that anyone has ever met. And we were having lunch, and I asked him what he was going to do when he moved from Kalamazoo to a kind of high mucky-muck place like Northwestern. And he said, well, the first semester, I'm teaching undergraduates for the first time in years and years, and so I've decided to teach them all ghost stories.
That was so I could pick Michael's brain.
We'll see you out in the lobby. Thank you very much for joining us.
You've been listening to a Lannan podcast. You can subscribe to our podcast at podcast.lannan.org. In addition, the Lannan Audio Archives present similar programs by national and international writers, poets, and social activists at www.lannan.org. Listen to hundreds of hours of recorded programs from the likes of Seamus Haney, Joy Harjo, Eduardo Galeano, Arundhati Roy, Jim Harrison, Edwige Danticat, and Noam Chomsky. New programs are added every month to both the podcast and the audio archives.